Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and welcome once again to Future Tense, the edge of change, new ideas, new approaches, new technologies. Now, here's something that caught our eye a few weeks ago. Dr. Kate Crawford, writing in the Harvard Business Review, had this to say. She said, "This looks to be the year that we reach peak big data hype." End of quote. Not peak big data, mind you, but peak big data hype. Dr. Crawford, I should mention, is a visiting professor at the MIT Center for Civic Media, and she's also a principal researcher at Microsoft Research. And her statement caught our eye because almost every second day there's a new article, blog post, or media release extolling the virtues of big data. But what exactly is big data? Is it simply the same as lots of data? And perhaps most importantly, is it as useful as we're told? Will it really govern our future? It's a term which has come up many times on this program in the past, and I'm sure most of us have a rough idea of what it entails. But how does one actually define it? One of our guests today is Robert Hillard, a partner and chief operating officer with Deloitte Consulting Australia. Here's what he understands by the term.
A few years ago, the term big data started to be coined, kind of reflecting the fact that there's a lot of data. But in the last 2 years, that term has really tightened up. It's not volume that we're talking about, it's complexity. You know, I can have very, very big databases. We've had them for years. But when we start looking at the data that we create, when we move around and we have location data being tracked on our mobile phone, that's extremely complex. When we look at the e-tags on our motor vehicles, that's very, very complex information.
Robert Hillard. And we'll come back to him shortly, and also to two other people involved in different ways and capacities with big data. But first, let's have a chat with Kate Crawford.
Certainly this is the year where the term is just being used everywhere. It's absolutely the jargon du jour. And in the US, we're seeing enormous conferences being hosted on big data. We're seeing columns in newspapers. The entire business and science world, they're talking about it all the time. And I think what's interesting about this is that the term itself is actually incredibly vague. It generally tends to refer to how we talk about analyzing massive data sets and the sorts of predictive analytics that we can do with that data, but it really covers an enormous range of activities, so the term itself is pretty useless. But even more concerning is this sort of emergence of the new big data fundamentalism, which is where people really seem to think that unless you have really large data sets, then you're not getting close to objectivity and truth. And I would really question how objective and also sometimes how truthful these big data sets really are.
It's a wonderful term, that big data fundamentalism. The idea almost that there's something just worthy in gathering all this stuff, not actually thinking about how it's going to be used and where it's coming from.
That's right. And I think we can really trace the roots of that idea back around 2008, where Chris Anderson, who was at that time the editor-in-chief of Wired magazine, wrote this very famous essay called The Petabyte Age, where he said that effectively big data would replace every other tool. And once we had enough data, the numbers would simply speak for themselves. And unfortunately, I mean, this is patently untrue. We know that numbers don't speak for themselves, and that actually people are the ones gathering the data, shaping the data. Data is never neutral. So in that sense, I think there are some real problems with the way this new fundamentalism is emerging, is that we've got the data, therefore we have access to truth.
And problems, you would say, with the methodology involved in gathering all of that data. Talk to us about that.
Well, look, my area is very much looking at how social media is currently being mined by big data scientists. And the difficulty here is that social media is already a particular kind of skewed set. So, for example, what we saw around Hurricane Sandy was that there were around 20 million tweets that went out specifically about that hurricane. So that's a significant data set that a lot of people are analyzing. But if you take a closer look at it, you will find that the vast majority of those tweets come from Manhattan. And in actual fact, the much more serious effects were being felt in areas outside of Manhattan, in places like Breezy Point and the Rockaways and areas in New Jersey, where we weren't getting anything like that amount of Twitter traffic. So it gives you this skewed sense that somehow Manhattan was the center of the disaster. So once you start analyzing that data, you're automatically taking this very privileged, very urban view of what was happening during that event. And this happens time and time again, that we forget that social media, I mean, in the US alone, less than 15 10% of the population actually use Twitter, for example. So it's already a kind of skewed self-selecting sample. And then we look at things like Foursquare, for example, which is also mined very commonly. It's even fewer people still. So what I've been doing is really looking at the methodologies that people are applying in some of these big data studies that try to draw on social media and looking at some of the problems that are inherent in using those data sets.
And if the methodologies are wrong, there are significant costs and problems there, aren't there? I mean, take your example of Hurricane Sandy. If you're a government agency or an emergency response agency and you're basing your response, trying to help people based on incorrect data sets, that's potentially enormously problematic, isn't it?
And this is what concerns me about the future of big data. If we don't start taking it very seriously now and looking at how it's used, we may mistake it for being really reliable data. Now, obviously, FEMA didn't just rely on Twitter data, but if they had, they would have had this very problematic set where they would have been ignoring wide areas of the US that were quite severely hit. The other, you know, classic example of a big data error this year was Google Flu Trends, which predicted quite accurately over the last 5 years how many people in the US would experience flu during the flu season. Now, this year, they said that 11% of the US would experience flu. That was almost double the real number, which was closer to 6. Now, what was interesting is that, of course, you know, Google can put out a figure like that and we can choose to ignore it. But if we saw that, you know, major groups like the CDC relied on that data, we would have some major problems. And this is something that concerns me, is thinking about when big data has impact on public policy. We have to be very careful in terms of how it might shift the way we use public resources.
So in essence, the data fundamentalists, as you call them, they're not really asking, they're looking at these data sets, but they're not really asking who or what is excluded. They're just looking at what they're gathering, what's included, if you like.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the most significant issues that I have at the moment with the way that big data is being used, is we always have to ask as scientists which people are not represented, which places are less visible in that data. What I'm referring to as signal problems, you know, where are the gaps in this data? What's the sort of the negative image that we're not seeing when we collect these data sets? Now, I think we can ask those questions and we can make big data science stronger by doing so, but it will only come when we actually start to move away from this hype that somehow essentially just by having a large data set, it's somehow representative, because of course they're not. And statisticians and a lot of people in the social sciences have a long experience of asking these kinds of critical questions about data. And I'm really hoping that we can see that kind of approach now being applied in big data science.
Dr. Kate Crawford, many thanks for joining us on Future Tense.
My pleasure.
You're with Future Tense, new ideas, new approaches, new technologies. We're available as a podcast via iTunes and ABC Online, and our name on Twitter is RN Future Tense, all one word.
Now, having set the scene, many thanks Kate Crawford, let's hear from three players in the big data field. Robert Hillard, who I introduced earlier from Deloitte Consulting Australia, Dr. Ian Opperman, Director of the Digital Productivity and Services Flagship at the CSIRO, Australia's premier science research institution, and Paul Cooper, Director of Emerging Solutions at SMS Management and Technology. All three joined me recently to try and flesh out the substance from the spin. Starting the conversation is Ian Opperman.
There is a tendency to collect things that can be collected, and not everything that can be collected is useful. And not everything which is useful is collected at the moment. So we find ourselves in a situation very often where governments and industry are just collecting data because it can be collected. The real value is when we can start to draw not just knowledge, but information and knowledge out of the data which is being collected.
And Paul Cooper, to make that data useful, you actually have to be looking for the right things in the first place, don't you? You have to be asking the right questions.
That's exactly right. In fact, we've got a bit of a terminology about, we should be talking about big knowledge rather than big data. And the way you get from data to knowledge is by asking the smart questions. So our thinking these days is it's really about formulating the right kind of questions that we can put up as hypotheses, if you like, things that we can ask of this information. And we think that's going to be requiring a whole lot of new skills to come through into the workforce, skills that are really around creativity, perhaps more so than traditional analytical thinking.
Now, we hear a lot of hype about the potential of big data, but I have to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't seem as though governments are doing a lot with data. It does seem as though the major technology companies are really the ones who are focused on the material that's being gathered. Is that correct?
Well, if I may jump in here first. Look, I think governments are actually doing a lot. They do have to work at a certain pace, mainly because they have to be extremely careful of privacy so that not unwittingly giving the citizens information away that should be protected. But if we look at the example of things like the personally controlled electronic health record and the putting in of that information on children's immunisation records and making it available to the population of Australia, that is really an example of the start of big data being turned into big knowledge. So if you register for a health record, you can find out right now when your children were immunised and start to find out what drugs and treatments they may have had, which makes it easier to keep a track of these things.
I think Paul is absolutely right. But one of the things we've got to be careful of when we talk about big data is it's not just about saying when I've got the data, there's something I can do with it. Pretty much everybody now is exploiting the core of the data that they have, be it government, be it business. The problem is actually going to the next level and getting true insight from it. And what people are finding is that the people who actually know the most about data are the originators of the data, you and me, when we provide our data to, whether it be to government or to business. So it's not just about having a black box where you apply analytics, but actually partnering with the creator and the consumer of those services. So those organisations that are the most successful actually put the control back into the hands of a citizen.
But do you really think that average citizens know anything about the data that they're producing, even that they are producing data? Say when they use a loyalty card, say, at Woolworths, or we know that a lot of people really have no understanding of data collection and companies like Google and Facebook. Is the population really at a stage where it has some power over the data that it's producing?
Or you can ask the question, can it afford not to be? Technical literacy is almost essential to be able to operate in today's society. If you don't understand what data you're giving away, you don't necessarily know what the consequences are of giving it away. And government has a huge role in actually ensuring transparency in what data is being collected from you, and then also providing clarity on who owns that data. When somebody takes some data, do they take ownership of that data, or does it still belong to you, and do you have a right to withdraw it at any stage in the future?
But is that in a world that is increasingly commercial, where, you know, say, take again Facebook or any social media platform, to engage in that, you actually have to give over some of your data. You have no choice. You've got the choice of either not taking part or taking part. In that kind of world, I mean, what sort of empowerment is there for an individual?
Look, if I may jump in on that one, that's not entirely true. What you're increasingly finding is that there are graded levels of privacy. So take the Facebook example or Twitter. You can actually discriminate the amount of information that you're willing to release to other people. You can say you're not willing for people to see your wall, or you don't want to share your photos, or you don't want location information of the photo made available. Now, some people just go, in fact, many people just go with the standard defaults. But there is a graded capability for you to turn on or turn off what privacy you're willing to give up in order to get potential benefits. And this is what we think needs to happen with government services as well. So citizens actually become able to be in control as individuals with the information that they're willing to being able to share, if you like, to perhaps get faster services, more information available on their health, to other organisations when they travel. There are a whole lot of benefits, but they need to be in control would be the point I'd make.
But the question on control, if I can just challenge for a second, the two options we've got, we can either take a privacy regime and we can ask government to define a privacy regime that gives us the ability to take control on what's made visible and how information is used. But ultimately, we're at the mercy of the people who've taken ownership of the data. Or alternatively, we can move to a personally controlled record regime where we define that ownership actually stays with a defined person and you effectively lease the data So when you take part in a loyalty scheme, you effectively lease the data to the company that runs the loyalty scheme, but you have the option of withdrawing that data at a future stage. Now, that's quite a fundamentally different structure and actually takes a lot of the pressure off the privacy regime, because once people know that they've got the option of being able to opt out at a future stage, they're a lot more comfortable to be able to allow their data to be opened up and exploited in a whole range of ways.
But my question again would be, I suppose, in hearing what you're saying there, has the horse already bolted? I mean, when you're living in an era where all of your electronic interactions and transactions are recorded and potentially being used by somebody else, is it really too late to start thinking about those forms of regulation? Robert Hillard.
It will be too late in a very little while, because what we've got is, you go to more and more websites, you find there are a small number of social networks that are positioning themselves as the primary gateway for identity. Associated with that identity is also a sign over of the rights to your information. Now, as that goes on, more and more of that information will have its rights assigned. So the time is very much now to decide, what the rules will be around those rights, and whether or not, in Australia's national interest, whether or not we want to handle our information differently. And this has all sorts of consequences in the digital economy, because associated with information is value. The more of our economy that moves into the digital world, the more difficult it is to maintain taxation levels at the level where they are. And the question we have to ask is, how do we avoid more of the value-adding activities from moving away from Australia and away from areas where we can actually tax?
Ian Opperman, picking up on that point, it's a good point, isn't it? Because the digital world is a global digital world. So when we're talking about regulation, or we're even talking about just maximising potential from data in a jurisdiction like Australia, say, we can't really just think of it, or it's very difficult to think of it being locked away in that sort of sense, isn't it?
It certainly is the case that once you enter the digital world, you really are playing on a global stage. But there's a very interesting point around the personalisation of services, which is in itself a real value add. You want things to be better targeted to you. You want things to be better targeted to your needs. And the amount of personal information that you give up, you can't avoid having a digital footprint. And if that's used on an aggregate basis to understand how many transactions, what sort of trends and things that people are engaged in, that's one real use of the information that it's really unavoidable in terms of controlling that. It gets important when it comes back to you as an individual and how your information, and really information more than data, is being used to direct things towards you, whether you want it or not, and how much control you have over about your personal information. The personally controlled electronic health record is an example of giving power back to the individual so that they have much greater control over their own information. But still, whatever you do, wherever you go, you're on video, you create a digital footprint, you touch cell phone towers, you touch the digital world, and that digital information is really part of a global scene.
Paul Cooper, your thoughts?
Yes, look, I'd like to just add into that whole discussion on the personal control, because I'm a great advocate for it. I do think that the citizen and the consumer needs to be in control of things. But there's a conundrum here. The more controls you put in place, and the more you say it's an opt-in service and that we have these abilities to control our own privacy, the slower it is to actually achieve a critical mass in terms of the utilisation and sharing of that information. And what we're seeing at the moment, for example, in health environment in Australia is a reasonably slow take-up rate for the electronic health record. Now, that will improve and that will get faster. But because people are in control, it's going to be a slower process. If it's just like signing up to Facebook and you give away everything, or you choose to accept the defaults, and that's a very rapid process. So there is a little bit of societal thinking that needs to take place here on what benefits are we trying to achieve versus the amount of control we need to provide our people, and what level we put that lever at right at the start when we launch the service.
And of course, that's also true for commercial enterprises, isn't it? I know that Mark Zuckerberg has made the point that, you know, people talk about wanting to have more control over the data that Facebook gathers, but his argument would be that they can provide better services, better tailored services. I mean, there is a logic to that kind of argument, isn't there?
There is. And if I may again build on that point too, we're only at the very start, as Robert was saying before, we're at the cusp of the amount of information being vastly greater. I was attending a conference just in the last few days, and they're talking about enabling your DNA gene sequencing and so on to be electronically stored very cheaply fairly rapidly just in the next few years, and you will be able to then have that cross-matched. This is the big data aspect to this, or the big knowledge. You'll have it cross-matched to disease types, to all sorts of genetics, inheritance markers and so on. A lot of benefits for you as an individual to have that kind of information shared, but a lot of risks too. There's insurance risks, there's all sorts of things. So these things have to be worked through very carefully, and it's going to occur at such a rate that we do have to think very carefully as a society about how we get the right level of control.
And you're listening to Future Tense and to a discussion about the nature and potential of what's called big data. I'm Anthony Fennell, and our guests are Dr. Ian Opperman, Director of the Digital Productivity and Services Flagship at the CSIRO, Australia's premier science research organisation, Paul Cooper, Director of Emerging Solutions at SMS Management and Technology, and Robert Hillard, a partner and chief operating officer with Deloitte Consulting Australia. Now, Ian Opperman, we were talking about speed just before. Timeliness is an issue in terms of the data that's being gathered, because it's one thing to collect vast amounts of data, but not all of it is going to be worth keeping for any great length of time. How do you factor in that issue of timeliness in a meaningful way?
Look, absolutely. In the big data problem, we talk about volume, velocity, variety and veracity, and the velocity is a very significant component. The biggest example, or the best example we've got at the moment, is our radio telescope being built out in Western Australia, which are producing 1.9 terabits per second per antenna, which is a million bits every second. So you could fill up a DVD in 4 seconds out of each one of these antennas, and there's 36 of them. There's no way we can keep all of that data. So we need to throw away a lot of it. And that's really pushing really the boundary of what's possible to store, what's possible to keep, what's possible to process. But ultimately, we need to move from the data to the information to the knowledge. And when you're searching for the origins of the universe, which is a pretty big problem, there's a lot of space to look through, and there's quite a lot of data to sort through. And the volume and the velocity are very, very serious components about getting those little grains of knowledge out.
Robert Hillard, the idea of the digital divide, which has been a notion that's been around for a very long time, it occurs to me that if we're talking about very large amounts of data and processing it for good, either for a national good or say for a corporate good, that there's going to be a great difference between those companies who have the money to do it effectively and those who don't. Is there going to be a divide opening, or are we seeing a divide opening up in that sphere?
There is absolutely a digital divide. There's a digital divide between those individuals who are well educated on how to use technology and how to make sure their data is used most effectively to their benefit. And there's a divide between businesses that are able to use data effectively and achieve good for their customers. And the problem is in Australia is that our effectiveness in the use of IT is actually dropping on a world scale. Yeah, we are getting more conservative. The nations that we are competing against are getting better faster than we are. And as a nation, we need to catch up very, very quickly. Otherwise, we'll get outcompeted in the global digital economy.
Paul Cooper, your thoughts?
Look, I would absolutely agree with that. And that's why we're putting the emphasis on getting the right kind of thinking coming up into our workforce. So we're getting the creative thinking. We're getting the smart people who can ask the smart questions. We think this is a strategic advantage of Australia. We've seen it in the past through the great work of CSIRO and other organisations where the innovative thinking has really been at the forefront of the world. I think we need to encourage that through our education system, so we're not just consumers of this information, but we are actually value-adding to it in a way that keeps Australia well in the forefront, and I think we can do that.
Ian Opperman, one thing we haven't really talked about is big data and storage, about the rights of the companies who store all of this data. Talk to us about that.
That is another really interesting challenge. So the first part of the challenge really is developing significant storage. Our radio telescope example, we're building exabyte storage, which is it's big, but it's certainly not big enough to cope with the amount of data which is being produced. But if you're a company storing data on behalf of other people, one of the big problems is working your way through the regulations associated with data sovereignty and your custodial responsibilities. There's quite a lot of activity happening at state and federal level trying to work through just what your obligations are as a company required to store, as a company who's required then to remove, and how you could actually prove that you've removed all possible traces of all data that you had responsibility for. That's part of the regulatory challenge which we're facing, and the technology and the opportunities and the value which and the use cases which are being created are moving so much faster than regulation, and in some cases even so much faster than technology.
Could I just add one thing there? One of the attributes of big data is that it can actually become almost impossible to purge information from once it's been assembled. So, yeah, just imagine that you're driving down the toll road and you get to the end of a trip and you think, you know what, I don't want anyone to know that I made that trip. Now, think about all the places that your electronic tag record has to be removed from. If you just remove the database from the database that recorded the trip, it now won't balance to the finance records or to the toll gates. If you remove it from the finance systems, they now won't match up to the maintenance systems. And this matching up keeps on going all the way back. The whole will be highly visible no matter how far back you go. Big data becomes incredibly complex incredibly quickly.
Now, we have to finish up, but it just occurs to me that if we're talking about big data and we're talking about big money, and we are talking about these grey areas, if you like, in terms of ownership, sovereignty, in terms of regulation, we are a very litigious world, aren't we? Are we starting to see a lot of this being played out in courtrooms? Is the law having a legal cases having an influence in determining issues around data and its usage?
The short answer is no, and I think the industry has been waiting with bated breath for a number of cases to start to hit. One of the reasons why there hasn't been the cases appearing yet, I would suggest, is because the accounting rules for the value of information have actually not been agreed. They've been in flux and negotiation since the early 1990s. But today, we've talked today about the value of information, and a company that collects lots of information gets lots of value. Yet you're not actually allowed to put it on the balance sheet and say, I have this asset worth a certain amount. Now, once you actually do that, you actually now have something that will generate a lot more litigation than we've necessarily seen to date.
And Ian, just to take us out, your thoughts?
I think we are starting to see a response from both state and federal governments about clarity of existing regulations and policies, but also starting to be much clearer about the custodial responsibilities of those using data, their legal requirements as to how they're supposed to treat it, how they must treat it, and also then starting to appreciate that data is an asset. It's an information asset which does need to be considered in both the regulatory framework and also from an economic perspective.
Well, Dr. Ian Opperman from the CSIRO, Robert Hillard from Deloitte Consulting Australia, and also Paul Cooper from SMS Management and Technology, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.